That's very nice indeed to be back on your campus again. The last time that I read my poems here was at least 10 or 12 or somebody said last night 15 years ago. At any rate, it's been quite a little while, and certainly I hope that all the students who were here then have graduated by now. Otherwise, they might hear me read many of the same poems again today, because in reading my poems about the country, I have found out that if you don't read the poems that students seem to have read in the anthologies or studied in college and heard about, they are disappointed. So I find myself reading many of the same poems that I was reading 10 or 12 years ago now on my programs. People ask, I suppose, of every poet, when did you begin to write? They very often ask, how do you write poetry? And sometimes people even ask, why do you write poetry? So I'm going to try to answer those questions as I go along, and I'm going to begin at the very beginning and tell you how I became a poet, when I wrote my first poem, because it was a kind of accident, really. I was born in Joplin, Missouri, but I belonged to a family that was always moving, and I wasn't really due to have been born in Joplin. I was due to have been born in Guthrie, Oklahoma, but we moved 2 weeks before I was born, so I was born in Joplin. Then before I could even learn to remember my hometown, we moved again, moved all the way to Buffalo, New York. So they told me, I don't remember Buffalo either. The first place that I remember is a town called Lawrence, Kansas, where the University of Kansas is. And I more or less grew up in Kansas, with occasional movings to Missouri, or occasional movings to Colorado, or somewhere nearby. But I consider myself very American because Missouri is more or less the heart of our country, and Kansas is the very heart of the United States. There's a marker out there in that state marking the geographical center of our country. And so that's where I more or less grew up to the age of 13 or 14. Never wrote a thing, never dreamed about being a writer when I was a child. But when I was about 14, we moved to a town called Lincoln, Illinois, not too far from here. And we moved in November, I believe, in the fall of the year it was, certainly, about 4 or 5 weeks after the school term had begun. I was in the eighth grade. I don't believe they had junior high schools then, and you graduated in the eighth grade, then you went to high school. So I went into this eighth grade graduating class in Lincoln, Illinois, some weeks late, and on the day that I went into the class, they were talking about holding a class selection. It seemed that they had just become aware that the high school graduating officers. So this grammar school class wanted to have officers, too. So they were talking this day about the qualifications for a president, a secretary, and a treasurer, and so on. And they were going to have the nominations and election the next day. And the teacher was explaining to the class what each person would have to do if they were elected to an office, you see. So on the way home, I was talking about this with the one other Negro pupil in the class, a girl. And she said, oh, well, we don't have to worry about that old class election. They never elect Negroes to anything in these schools around here. This is a prejudiced little town, she told me. Well, it turned out, it seemed that she was just about right, certainly in regard to herself, because the next day, the nominations were made, and everybody was voted on, president, secretary, treasurer, and so on. The colored girl was not nominated for anything, although she had been with these pupils for the whole eighth grade. Well, when they got way down at the last office, way down at the bottom of the board, under sergeant at arms even, it was the office of class poet, and there weren't any nominations. No nominations whatsoever. And everybody looked around at each other and wondered who in the world to nominate for class poet. It seemed that there was nobody in the class who'd ever written a poem, nobody who even looked like he or she might write a poem, and so there were no nominations at all. So finally the teacher said, well, don't you want a class poet? And everybody said, yes. And she said, well, you have to nominate and elect someone. So at this point, a little white boy got up and turned around and looked at me and called my name, and right away the whole class said, aye, unanimously, and that's the way... That is the way I became a poet, by unanimous acclamation in the eighth grade. Well, now, I didn't want to be class poet either. I'd never written a poem either. And I was a little bit put out, to tell the truth, that I was elected class poet. I wondered why. Well, as I thought about it that night at home, I came to the conclusion that it must have been because the day before, when the teacher was explaining the qualifications for a poet, she had stressed rhythm. She said a poem has to have rhythm. It has to sing. It must sometimes rhyme. It doesn't always have to rhyme, she said, but it does have to have rhythm. Well, now, you know, there is a kind of conventional belief in our country that all Negroes can sing and dance and that all of us have a sense of rhythm. Now, of course, that's not by any means 100% true. I happen to be one Negro that can't even carry a tune. In fact, I was excused from music all the way through high school because I threw everybody else off key. So it's certainly not true that all Negroes are rhythmical or musical at all. However, it is a kind of, conventional belief that it's true, a kind of cliche saying, really. And so I suppose that day, my white fellow classmates looking around and wondering who in the world to make class poet and remembering the word rhythm and looking at me colored, thought that I must have some rhythm to give a poem, and so they voted for me 100%. I, class poet Langston Hughes. So I was saddled with the class poem. Well, fortunately, I had all winter long to write that poem. It wasn't due until June for the class program, you know. So it turned out to be just about the longest poem I've ever written. I thought that I'd better have one verse for each teacher, and we had eight teachers, so there was eight verses. And I thought, well, the class certainly better have eight verses. So my first poem was 16 verses long, and real long verses, too. When I stood up and read this poem at graduation time, however, the parents, the teachers, the pupils, everybody seemed to like it. They all applauded very loudly. That was the first applause I'd ever had in my life, my first real appearance before a large crowd, I guess. And I was so pleased by all this applause that I thought to myself, well, I'll just keep on writing poems. So I did. The next year in high school, by this time, we had moved to Cleveland, Ohio. I went to Central High School in Cleveland. We had a very good school magazine called the Belfry Owl. I looked in the first issue or two, and I didn't see the names of any Negro pupils, quite a number of Negro pupils at Central at that time. Well, I've always had a lot of race pride, and I've always felt that we should do everything that any other American does. And so I thought to myself, well, if no other Negro students are trying to write for this magazine, I will try. So I began to write little poems, send them to our school magazine. Every month they came right straight back to my homeroom. Well, it wasn't prejudice, I'm sure. It was just they weren't very good. So they came back. But finally, one of my little poems was published in the high school magazine. And from that time on, almost every month until I graduated, I had something in the school magazine. I was again, not the class poet, but the class songwriter. I did the lyrics for the class song. The same thing happened in college. I was the class lyricist for my college class. So my literary career really began in school. It developed through the help of my teachers, particularly my English teachers in school. And my advice to anyone who wants to be a writer is simply to begin to write wherever you are, to publish in the very nearest publication. If you're in college, publish in your college publication or your hometown paper. And the main thing, I think, is to be published someplace, because when you see something in print that you've written, it takes on another perspective from when you see it on the paper where you put it down yourself, and you can judge it better. We had one teacher in high school to whom I owe a very great deal. She happened to be a teacher who liked modern poetry. Well, now, that wouldn't be too unusual today, but when I was in high school 30 or more years ago now, most of the teachers seemed to like only the poets who had died about 100 years before the pupils were born, you know, or 200 years before. Shakespeare and Longfellow and Browning and people way back there. But this teacher would read to us from Carl Sandburg, from Edna St. Vincent Millay, from Edgar Lee Masters, from Vachel Lindsay, from poets who were living and writing right while we were living and writing about things that we knew. And I particularly liked Carl Sandburg's poetry. And so when I began to try to write poetry seriously in high school, I tried to write like Carl Sandburg. On the other hand, I had grown up with the poems of Paul Ernst Dunbar, who was our first really fine Negro poet. He died about the time that I was born, but when I was a child, almost every Negro home had a volume of Dunbar's poems. And my grandmother used to read Dunbar to me, my mother used to recite him at church socials and so on. And so I also tried to write like Dunbar. Well, now, they're two quite different styles. Paul Ernst Dunbar was a kind of singing, lyrical poet. Often he wrote humorously. He often wrote in Negro dialect, the quaint, broken English of the period immediately following slavery in which he grew up. Sandburg, on the other hand, wrote, of course, as you know, in quite straightforward, plain English. He didn't rhyme. Often he didn't have a very obvious rhythm. In other words, he wrote free verse. Well, at that time, free verse was considered very radical. And I remember one of the big magazines denounced Carl Sandburg quite roundly as being not a poet at all. We don't think that way anymore about unrhymed poetry, but then they did. Well, I want to read you two of my very earliest poems, which will, I think, answer the question as to when I began to write and how I began to write. And I'll read you two that were written in high school. The first one is a poem in the manner of Paul Ernst Dunbar, a little Negro dialect poem called Dressed Up. And it's about a boy who put on his best clothes. He got all dressed up, and then he found out he didn't have any girlfriend to go see. So this is the way it goes. I had my clothes clean, just like new. I put them on, but it still feels blue. I bought a new hat, sure is fine, but I wish I had back that old gal of mine. I got new shoes, they don't hurt my feet, but I ain't got nobody for to call me sweet. Sad one, isn't it? Well, a year or two later, I wrote another one about a very beautiful brown-skinned girl who came into our school from down south. At that time, the first of the great migrations of colored people from the south to the big northern industrial cities was taking place, and this girl came up from the south and into our school wearing a bright red dress. And I tried to describe the way she looked to me. Well, I was too shy in those days to put her real name on the poem. The poem is called When Sue Wears Red. Her name wasn't Sue, but this is the way I described it. When Susanna Jones wears red, her face is like an ancient cameo turned brown by the ages. Come with a blast of trumpets, Jesus. When Susanna Jones wears red, a queen from some time-dead Egyptian night walks once again. Blow trumpets, Jesus. And the beauty of Susanna Jones in red burns in my heart a love fire, sharp like pain. Sweet silver trumpet, Jesus. That's the way that girl looked at me every time she went down the hall. But she didn't marry me. She married somebody else no sooner than she got out of high school. And the last time I was in Cleveland, I heard that she's been married 3 times. You will notice that this poem that I just read you is a pre-verse poem. At that time, it was as nearly as I could write a poem in the style of Carl Sandburg. I think you can definitely see his influence in the poem. But you can also see the influence of the Negro spirituals in the little refrain. But she didn't marry me. She married somebody else no sooner than she got out of high school. And the last time I was in Cleveland, I heard that she's been married 3 times. You will notice that this poem that I just read you is a pre-verse poem. At that time, it was as nearly as I could write a poem in the style of Carl Sandburg. I think you can definitely see his influence in the poem. But you can also see the influence of the Negro spirituals in the little refrain. And I wasn't aware of being influenced by folk songs at that time, but later on, I became aware of how often they crept into my poetry, and then I deliberately began to try to write poems in the manner of the spirituals and the blues. So I might read you maybe one or two of those right now. The Negro spirituals, I'm sure you know, are a folk form that has gone out of existence, that is, as far as being newly created goes, the great spirituals like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and Go Down Moses have sort of become American classics, I guess you might say. And spirituals are no longer being made up by the people. But the blues are a living folk form right now today. The blues are not as old as the spirituals. The spirituals go way back to slavery time. The blues are, as nearly as anybody can tell, a kind of folk form that came into bloom really around the early 1900s. And the first blues to be written down on paper, you know, was W.C. Handy's Memphis Blues. And then a few years later, he wrote the very famous St. Louis Blues, which I think is a very interesting song because in traveling all around the world, I used to be in the Merchant Marine, and then later I went around the world as a writer to Asia and all around. And everywhere, almost as I have been, you hear the St. Louis Blues. I heard it in Japan, played on Japanese jukeboxes, sung in Japanese. I heard it in Russia, sung in Russian. And in Central Europe and in Paris, the St. Louis Blues is a very popular song. In fact, many Europeans used to think that the St. Louis Blues was the American national anthem. You know, whenever a tourist would go in a restaurant, they'd immediately begin to play the St. Louis Blues. I don't know if they still do that now or not. But you may remember reading a story in Time at the end of the war when the German occupation troops were withdrawing from Paris and the American troops were coming in and the first American reporters were going into liberated Paris. And they heard over all the loudspeakers on the street corners, you know, the Germans had installed loudspeakers for propaganda purposes. And over these loudspeakers, I heard the St. Louis Blues being played. I suppose as a welcome to the American troops, probably. But the Germans were still within the city limits, and the censorship presumably was still on. And one of the reporters was very curious as to how the French people could get away with playing the St. Louis Blues, because Hitler had banned, as you know, all Negro music and Jewish music, and particularly blues like the St. Louis Blues. So this man went to the radio station and asked about this, and he was told that the French people in Paris had played the St. Louis Blues all during the Nazi occupation. And he asked, well, how could you get away with it? And they said, well, we told the Hitler censorship people that the St. Louis Blues really wasn't an American song at all, that the Americans had simply stolen it from the French. It really is an old French folk song, and the St. Louis is really about Louis Quatorze, and and the woman with the diamond rings was Marie Antoinette, and so on. Well, anyway, that simply indicates how much they like our American blues music over there, you know? So when I began to try to write poems in the manner of our folk, Negro folk music, first the spirituals and then the blues, I, at that time, seemed to be doing something that no other American poets were trying to do. But since then, quite a few of our poets have written in the idiom of these songs, but 20 years ago, apparently nobody was doing it very much. And so it was my poems in this style that first really attracted any attention to my work. And before I tell you how I got my first literary prize and so on, what really started my professional career, I'll read you a little one called Feet of Jesus, a very short little poem that you might almost call the breath of a spiritual. It goes like this. At the feet of Jesus, sorrow like a sea, Lordy, let your mercy come drifting down on me. At the feet of Jesus, at your feet I stand. Oh, my precious Jesus, please reach out your hand. And now, in the manner of the blues are quite different from the spirituals in form and subject matter. The spirituals have no set form, really. One spiritual may be quite different from another. But the traditional blues are always a long lyric line repeated, and then a third line that rhymes with the first two. And I try to preserve that traditional form in my poems. And then the subject matter of the blues is almost always a very sad subject matter, usually about being broke, a long ways from home, hungry, out of work. Those are the blues that the men sing. The blues, by the way, are individual songs, too. The spirituals are group songs. But the blues are usually sung by one man or one woman alone. And the women usually sing about affairs of the heart, usually about some man who's gone off and left her before she's ready for him to go. I will read you a blues for a man to sing, and you can tell that this blues was written some years ago because it mentions the WPA. It's a Depression time blues, but it's sort of typical of the of one phase of subject matter in the blues, of being out of work. And this one goes like this. I walked the streets till the shoes wore off my feet. I done walked the streets till the shoes wore off my feet. I've been looking for a job so that I could eat. I couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. Couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. WPA man told me, you got to live here a year and a day. A year and a day, Lord, in this great big lonesome town. A year and a day in this great big lonesome town. I might starve for a year, but that extra day would get me down. Well, that is the mood of the blues, usually despondency, but something somewhere in the lyric that will make people laugh. A poem of mine called The Weary Blues that gave the title to my first book won the Opportunity Prize. Opportunity was the Negro magazine of the Urban League. The prize was $50. I was living in Washington at the time, working as a busboy at the Wardman Park Hotel, when I got word that I had received this poetry award, and they asked me to come to New York to the literary banquet being given to receive my prize. Well, $50, I spent my prize going to get it because it cost almost that much to go to New York from Washington and get this money. So I didn't really benefit by the money, but the publicity from it. There was an editorial in the Herald Tribune, I believe, and articles in the papers. It really began my career. Editors paid some attention to this award. I got a note from Vanity Fair, which was a magazine sort of like Harper's Bazaar at that time, asking me for poetry. I got another note from the New Republic. And so I began to have my poetry published in real paying magazines. In other words, I got paid for a few poems. Up to that time, I'd just given them away. Well, now, please don't anyone here think you can really make a living from poetry. You can't. Unfortunately, even today, I think most magazines don't pay any more than 50 cents a line. That's one reason poets make their lines as short as they can, you know, so they can have a lot of lines. And most of my poems are really quite short. And so when I got my first checks for my poems, fortunately, Vanity Fair bought a whole group of them and paid me $75. Gee, I thought that was an awful lot of money, and I still do. But most of the time, I would get maybe $5 or $6 or $8 for a poem, and that would be all. And that is true right now. So that is one reason why I went into other forms of writing, I guess. I realized that I couldn't really live as a writer from poetry, so I tried to write stories and novels and radio scripts and plays, and from those, I have managed now to live for about 25 years without having had a job. I've looked for jobs, but haven't found them. Occasionally, I've been invited to teach creative writing, and I have done it for a semester, but haven't really had a regular job in a long time. I have really made a living as a writer, more or less from the time, or from a few years after the time that I received this prize. Well, another very nice thing that happened to me, and that helped me greatly, was that while I was working in the Wardman Park Hotel dining room, Vachel Lindsay came into the dining room one day. He was reading his poems in the little theater of the Wardman Park Hotel in Washington, which at that time was the leading hotel before the Mayflower was built. Many of the senators and diplomats stayed there. And I very much wanted to hear Vachel Lindsay read his poems. I'd never seen him before. I'd loved his poetry. And here he was going to give them himself in person that night in the little theater of this hotel. But I couldn't go. I couldn't buy a ticket. They wouldn't sell tickets to Negroes to any theater in Washington, as I'm sure you know, until just in recent years could we go to a public place in the city of Washington outside the Negro district. So I couldn't hear Vachel Lindsay. So I thought, well, I'll give him some of my poems to read anyway. So between lunch and dinner, I wrote some of my poems out, including The Weary Blues that won the prize, and put them down beside his plate at dinner in the dining room. I was very shy in those days, so I didn't say anything to him except that I try to write poetry too and hear some of my poems or something like that, and I went away, and I didn't see him anymore. Well, the next morning when I came to work, there were reporters out there and cameraman, and they were all waiting for me at 7 o'clock in the morning. And they said, "You've been discovered." And it turned out that Vachel Lindsay had read on his own program all three of the poems that I had given him and had told the people that he thought that I was a poet of talent and, in other words, had given me a wonderful send-off, and it was all in the morning papers, but I hadn't read the papers. And so the reporters interviewed me, and they took a picture of me in the middle of the dining room holding up a big tray of dishes, and I was discovered. Well, a few months thereafter, my first book was published, and so that is the way I became a professional writer and a professional poet. Now, many of my poems deal with the problems of segregation and prejudice in our country, and so I might just as well read you one or two of them now, since I just been talking about one phase of that problem. Also, at the time that I was working as a busboy and trying to save enough money to go to college, jobs like running elevators and shining shoes and being a porter were almost the only kinds of jobs that young Negroes could get. Fortunately, things have changed greatly in our country, particularly since the last war. And it's no longer true that in most of the larger communities, Negroes need be limited to menial jobs, but it was true at that time. Now, in big cities like New York and Chicago and Detroit, as I'm sure you all know, you see Negro clerks in the downtown shops. In New York, you see Negro girls as cashiers sometimes in Macy's or Bloomingdale's or Lord & Taylor's, and all that has changed. Formerly, a Negro girl couldn't even be a switchboard operator for the telephone company, but in many cities now, Negro girls can. Well, anyway, some of my very early poems were particularly about the problem of color and work. And I'll read you one that you probably have all seen or studied sometime or other because it's in the Undermeyer anthology, among others, that's used in many of the English courses. One called Brass Spittoons. It goes like this. Clean the spittoons, boy. Detroit, Chicago, Atlantic City, Palm Beach. Clean the spittoons. The steam in hotel kitchens, and the smoke in hotel lobbies, and the slime in hotel spittoons, part of my life. Hey, boy, a nickel, a dime, a dollar, $2 a day. Hey, boy, a nickel, a dime, a dollar, $2, buy shoes for the baby, house rent to pay, parties on Saturday, church on Sunday. My God. Babies and parties and church and women and Sunday, all mixed up with dimes and dollars and clean spittoons and house rent to pay. Hey, boy, a bright bowl of brass is beautiful to the Lord. Bright, polished brass, like the cymbals of King David's dancers, like the wine cups of Solomon. Hey, boy, a clean spittoon on the altar of the Lord. A clean, bright spittoon, all newly polished. At least I can offer that. Come here, boy. I think you can again see the Sandburg influence on that early poem of mine. Out of the many poems about the problems of Negroes and democracy that I've written, the one that perhaps has been most often reprinted and most often used by interracial groups is one called Merry-Go-Round. And maybe people have found it effective for interesting people in the race problem because it's a poem about a child. This poem was written shortly after the beginning of the war. Many Negroes were being brought up from the South, as every time a war happens, they are brought up by labor contractors and so on to work in the steel mills and factories of the big northern industrial cities. And I imagined a little girl of maybe 7 or 8 years old or 9 or 10 who had grown up in maybe Birmingham or somewhere, coming up to, say, a city like Joliet or Chicago or Omaha with her parents. And the little girl goes to a carnival in a northern or western city, and she sees a merry-go-round going around, and she wants to ride. But she remembers down south where she's lived that there are a lot of things that colored people can't ride on. If they can ride, they have to ride in the back. And so this is what this little colored child. The little colored child at the carnival sells. The poem is called Merry-Go-Round. Where is the Jim Crow section on this merry-go-round, mister? Because I want to ride. Down south where I come from, white and colored can't sit side by side. Down south on the train, there's a Jim Crow car. On the bus, we're put in the back. But there ain't no back to a merry-go-round. Where's a horse for a kid that's black? Well, of course, I feel that our country's big enough and rich enough to have a horse for every kid. And I think we will eventually achieve that. But we haven't yet, as you know. In spite of the very great advances that have been made in race relations, particularly in the North and in the far West, there are sections of our country where still a Negro kid can't ride on a merry-go-round at all. Well, I couldn't seem to make enough money to go to Howard in Washington as I wanted to, working as a busboy. So I got a scholarship to go to Lincoln through my poetry. Scholarship came to me on account of my poetry. I went to Lincoln University near Philadelphia, graduated from there in 1929, and ever since I've been making a living from writing. My father was a very practical man who lived in Mexico. He was a lawyer down in Mexico City. And when he found out I wanted to be a writer, he wouldn't send me any more money to help me be anything. He thought I was out of my mind. And so during the years between my first semesters at college at Columbia and going back to college at Lincoln, I worked on the boats for about 2 years. And I went to Africa, went to Europe, and I'd always wanted to see Paris, so on one of my trips to Europe, a very rough and unpleasant trip in the middle of the winter anyway, didn't enjoy it very much, I decided to get off the boat and go to Paris. I'd studied French in high school. You know, I'd had 4 years of it, and I'd had a year of it at Columbia. So I thought, well, I speak French well enough to get a job in Paris, I'm sure. So I had $25 coming on the boat. I drew my money, didn't tell them I was going to Paris. They just thought I'd drew my money to spend in Rotterdam. I bought a ticket to Paris. Got there very early in the morning, 7 o'clock on a cold, snowy morning. Didn't know a human soul in all of Europe. But I thought I'd try my French out right away, so I was hungry, so I went up to the counter in the Gare du Nord and asked for ham and eggs at the lunch counter. Well, they looked at me and didn't seem to understand what I was saying, so I repeated, Donnez-moi, s'il vous plaît, des œufs et du jambon. Looked at me again. I didn't know then the French don't eat ham and eggs for breakfast anyway, but I thought they might have understood the words. Didn't seem to understand the words either. So I saw the coffee urn over here and some rolls here. So I pointed at the coffee urn and I pointed at the rolls. And right away I got coffee and rolls. So I learned my very first morning in Paris that you don't really have to know the language in a foreign country to get along. You can just use sign language and get anything you want, almost. Anything except a job. I couldn't find a job with sign language. I lived on coffee and rolls, or maybe I should say coffee and a roll for almost a month per meal, just a coffee and a roll or something. Finally, I got a job as a doorman in a nightclub. It turned out to be a very tough nightclub, kind of underworld, gangster nightclub. And I didn't realize that if you were a doorman, you were also supposed to be the bouncer. And they used to fight in this nightclub with champagne glasses that they would smash on the edge of the table and then cut at each other with the jagged edges of the glasses. And they did this in all kinds of European languages. It was kind of international club. So I never even knew what the fights were about, but I was supposed to stop them. So I didn't stay there very long. I found a job in another nightclub as a second cook. When they asked me could I cook, I said, oh, yeah. And I couldn't cook a thing in the world. But it turned out, fortunately, that the title second cook was honorary anyway. It really meant dishwasher. So it was something that I could do. And I'm telling you this because a whole phase of my poetic development grew out of my working in these nightclubs. The second nightclub where I worked had a very good Negro jazz band from New York. A little band, but it was an excellent one. Frank Withers was a member of it, one of the old jazz players you may have heard of, and Buddy Gilmore played drums in it, one of the great old-time drummers who since died. And so I used to hear this jazz band every night playing while I was washing dishes and pots and pans back in the kitchen. And the beat of this jazz music sort of got into my blood, and I began to try to reproduce it in poetry, to catch the rhythm of jazz in poems. And I think my jazz poems were probably the first of my poems to attract really wide attention outside of the literary circles of people who just read poetry anyway. This is one of them. It's a poem called Negro Dancers, and I read you this one because it will date the period for you. The period when I was working in Paris was the period of the Charleston, an American dance that began in New York, I guess, and just sort of swept all the way around the world. Josephine Baker, I think, brought it over to Europe, and everybody was trying to do the Charleston. So I wrote this poem called Negro Dancers at that time that goes like this. Me and my baby's got two more ways to do the Charleston. Da, 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 da. Two more ways to do the Charleston. Soft light on the tables, music gay, brown-skinned steppers in a cabaret. White folks laugh, white folks pray, 'cause me and my baby's got two more ways to do the Charleston. Well, I have since written quite a number of poems in which I try to capture some of the syncopation of jazz music in one style or another, and I would like to read you now some more recent ones, not really very recent, because these are of the bebop period, and those of you who know jazz music know that the bebop period was probably at its height around 1948, 49, 50 in there. These poems try to capture something of the idiom of the jive talk that lies behind bebop, too. And as you know, many of the bop words or jive words have become a part of our American language, and you hear them on the radio, and the comedians use them all the time, and other people, too. Everybody now knows what jive means, or cool, or dig, but 10 years ago, everybody didn't. This is a poem called Motto. It doesn't have anything really to do with music, but I'll read it to you as a kind of preliminary to one or two of the jazz or bop poems about the music itself. This is in Harlem Jive Talk, and it's about a cool cat, and it goes like this. I play it cool and dig all jive. That's the reason I stay alive. My motto, as I live and learn, is dig and be dug in return. Well, you know, in Harlem, we have a lot of night funerals. I don't know, I never saw night funerals in any other city myself. Maybe they have them in Chicago, don't know, but I don't remember ever seeing any. But in Harlem, almost every night, you can see a funeral or so going down 7th Avenue or Lenox Avenue. And I suppose the reason for these night funerals is that many of the mourners just couldn't get off from work to come to a funeral in the daytime. At any rate, they have the funerals at night, and then the deceased is buried early next morning with nobody there. This poem is a poem about the funeral of a hap cat, and it's called Dead In There. Dead In There. It goes like this. Sometimes a night funeral going by carries home a rebop daddy. Hearse and flowers guarantee he'll never hype another patty. It's hard to believe, but dead in there, he'll never lay a hype nowhere. He's my ace boy gone away. Wake up and live, he used to say. Squares who couldn't dig him, plant him now, out where it makes no diff, no how. And now a poem called Flatted Fifths. Those of you who follow bop music know what flatted fifths are. Little colored boys with beards, rebop, bebop, mop and stop. Little colored boys with fears, frantic, kick their drafty years into flatted fifths and flatter beers that out of sudden change become sparkling oriental wines, rich and strange, silken bathrobes with gold twines, and Heilbrunner, Crawford, Nat undreamed of Lewis combines in silver thread and diamond notes on trademarks inside Howard coats. Little colored boys in bare rays, oop papa da, horse of fantasy of days, ooh yaku, and dig all plays. And then just a couple more about music. This one is called Jam Session. Letting midnight out on bail, Papa Da, having been detained in jail. Ooh, Papa Da, for sprinkling salt on a dreamer's tale, Papa Da, while bebop boys implore Mecca to achieve six discs with Decca. Little colored boys with fears, frantic, nudge their drafty years, Papa Da. Well, when I had my first book published, I didn't know whether people would really like my poems or not. I guess every writer feels that way about his writing. You wonder what's going to happen. And I really didn't know when I got out of college. That time I'd just finished my first novel. I wrote it on the campus in college, another instance of my literary work being tied up with my scholastic work. Didn't know quite how I was going to manage to live from this writing, but by that time I really wanted to be a writer and live from my writing. And I had the good fortune of being advised by Mary McLeod Bethune, the very great Negro woman who died about a year ago, head of the Bethune-Cookman College down in Florida, of being advised by her to take my poetry to the college students of the South and read it to them. And she said they will love your poetry and they'll buy your books and the schools will pay you something to come and read too. Well, I began to try to do it. I wrote a few letters, and sure enough, let's say out of 10 letters, I would get 6 answers back to come and read my poems. And I wondered how much I could charge. And so she said, well, I think the bigger schools at least could pay you $100. So I would start with $100. Some of the schools really would pay $100 to hear you read poetry, which seems to me amazing, you know? By the way, I'm not being paid $100 today. If I were, I'd read 2 hours instead of one. So anyway, when the answers would come back that they couldn't pay $100, then I would write a letter and say, well, since I'm going to be coming that way anyway, I will read my poems to you for $75. And sometimes then the answer would come back, well, we really just can't afford that on this campus, and our students are so poor, and our teachers' salaries haven't been paid for 2 months, and so on. So then I'd write and say, well, could you consider 50? And if they couldn't consider 50, I'd come down to 25. And if they couldn't consider 25, then I would write and say, well, I'm coming through there anyway, and I've always wanted to see your campus, and I would be delighted to read my poems to you in return for your hospitality overnight. And so the result was that I found myself reading my poetry somewhere almost every night all throughout the whole South. I had a little Ford car, and I drove around. And my tour extended from New York all the way down to Florida, from Florida all the way across to Texas. And by that time, I'd gotten bold enough to ride to California. And so my very first lecture tour extended from New York to Florida to Texas all the way up the coast of Seattle. And I must have read my poems during that year, that winter, to maybe 50,000 or more students and other people. And so that is the way I began to make a living from writing. I tell you all these things because I gather that many of you here are English students or writing students and maybe people who want to know how you can, what you can do with writing to really make it pay a little bit. I have never been a bestseller. I've never had a book of the month. I've never had a book on the bestseller list. I'm not a wealthy writer. I haven't had the good fortune of Frank Yerby or Richard Wright or Willard Motley to have a knock on any door that sold 100,000 copies. But nevertheless, I have managed to live from poetry, from prose, from stories, and from reading my poems. Now, in conclusion, perhaps I should read you again two or three of the older of my poems that have been anthologized a great many times and that perhaps many of you have read or heard. Some of them have been set to music. The one that I'm going to read you now, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, for example, has had several musical settings. One by Howard Swanson that perhaps you've heard Marian Anderson sing. Another by Margaret Bonds that you may have heard Adam Moten or Muriel Ron or Todd Duncan sing. And this poem, I promised to tell you how I write a poem. I perhaps by indirection explained it already, but I can tell you exactly how I happened to write this particular poem. It was written just after I'd graduated from high school. It's one of my very old poems. And my father had sent for me to come to Mexico to spend a year with him. And then he was going to send me to college. So I got on the train in Cleveland, went down to St. Louis and changed trains to go on down to the Texas border into Mexico. And the train that I was on went across the Mississippi River just at sunset time. So I found myself looking out the window of the train at this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South. And for the first time, I really began to think about what the Mississippi meant historically to the Negro people. How to be sold down that river in slavery time was one of the worst things that could happen, to be sold into the rice fields, the cane fields of the deep South. And then I remembered having read that Abraham Lincoln had gone down the Mississippi on a raft as a young man, and that he'd seen slavery at its worst in the deep South. For the first time in his life, he saw the slave markets in New Orleans. He never forgot these human beings being bought and sold so brutally and without care for what happened to them. And as we all know, many years later, it was Lincoln who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And somehow, in my own mind, this river began to link itself with rivers in our ancestral past, with the Congo and the Niger and the Nile in Africa. And so as the train went on into the night, I took out my father's letter, which was in my pocket here, and wrote down on the back of his envelope this poem, just about as I'll read it to you now. The Negro speaks of rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. Well, in closing, I'll read you just two other very short poems. This one is called I Too Sing America. Written a long time ago, too, but I think it's still quite valid in what it says today. I Too Sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat strong and grow well. Tomorrow, I'll sit at the table when company comes. Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America. And my feeling is that increasingly the contributions of the Negro people to America, the beauty that they have given our country, is being recognized and appreciated, and the Negro people themselves are more and more being assimilated into the national life of our country. But in some parts of our country, as we all know, not anywhere nearly fast enough for the pace of the times and for the pace of the way things are happening all around the world to colonial peoples and peoples who've hitherto been oppressed. Some of the colonial peoples that are achieving their freedom in Africa and Asia have more freedom than some of our own American, in quotes, citizens in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia. And so I think we need to move a little faster in some areas of our race relations in this country. But nevertheless, I think we can all look forward with the kind of optimism to tomorrow that I try to express in this final poem, a poem called Tomorrow. We have tomorrow bright before us like a flame. Yesterday, a night gone thing, a sundown name, and dawn today, broad arch above the road we came. We march, Americans together, we march.